This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, I'm David Gale and welcome to The Informer. Tonight I'm joined by Paul McClure. Tonight we will be talking with Megan Fitzgerald from the Fitzroy Legal Service about the case they are taking to the High Court on behalf of Doctors for Refugees. A little later we will be talking with Ben Decry, a privacy advocate, about you and the census night next Tuesday night. Last week, while reading the news here at Joy 94.9, I came across a story that caught my attention. A story that probably disappears ordinarily, but one that's worth looking at a little bit closer on The Informer tonight. Australian doctors last Wednesday launched a High Court challenge to controversial laws they say gag them from speaking out over child abuse and other threats to asylum seekers in detention centres. Tonight in the studio, we're joined by Megan Fitzgerald, Manager of Social Action, Law Reform and Policy. Long title. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Look, what can you tell us about this case? As I said, it caught my eye, and ordinarily I think these sorts of stories disappear a little bit in the news, and I know it's going to be a while for an outcome, but what can you tell us about this case?
Well, the first thing I'd say is we're definitely hoping it won't disappear. It's a very important issue, both in terms of the law, but also in terms of the discourse and the advocacy around it, and a lot of the public interest litigation we do, as much of it is about building discussion and thinking about the issues underneath as the case itself. This particular case has been brought by Doctors for Refugees, who've been very courageous over, I'd say, the last year. The legislation in question was enacted about a year ago. And they've been very courageous in pushing the boundaries and making disclosures around treatment and conditions that they find are creating an internal conflict in terms of their ethical duties. So doctors are quite a specific group in a way, not only because they have so much respect in the community, but they also have obligations under law which are to act in the best interests of their patients and to advocate for their patients. They also have obligations to report negligent conduct or treatment that they think is substandard, whether it's them or someone else. And
This all comes from their Hippocratic Oath, of course.
And other legal obligations as well. And they also, surprisingly, have an obligation to advocate for public health, which is quite an aspirational thing. But for doctors, that's a real ethical obligation within their scope. And I think as a profession that has high standing in the community, in a way, it's very encouraging that they've been willing to bring this legal action because maybe other people might not feel as confident.
Sure. Now, look, it takes a while to do this sort of, to even mount a case like this. I know that they had an open letter that was signed by about 40 medical practitioners, which was sent back on the 1st of July 2015 in response to the secrecy provisions of part of the, of the Border Force Act. And these people are, absolute heroes. The Doctors for Refugees have continued on from that point to mount this case. And just out of interest, why did they choose the Fitzroy Legal Service?
That's an interesting question. I think these cases are kind of born out of people's ideas and discussions. So I was working with a Silk, so that's a senior barrister, and we worked together and were talking, and I guess they come out of these esoteric discussions, the discussion spreads, and then someone comes to you and says, gee, I'd really like to run a case about this particular issue. And then Fitzroy Legal Service, we're a small organisation,
yeah.
but we have about 200 volunteers. We have really, really strong relationships with the pro bono sector. And when there's an important case, there's a very strong tradition in the law of people donating their time to further what they believe to be important questions of public interest. So we completely rely on that. So, for example, one of our last cases cost the government $1.7 million and it cost us $30,000 in terms of the way we work. We rely because so heavily on volunteers.
Donated their time. I know I've got a mate that's an immigration lawyer, and I asked him one day about some of the big cases, such as this sort of case, that are taken up to the High Court, whether it be for a person specifically that, you know, deserves a bit of a break under immigration law or whatever. And I said, well, you know, how come, you know, how do people mount these sorts of challenges? And I suppose we don't realise that a lot of people do donate their time. Certainly lawyers do, and, you know, they might get a bit of a bad rap sometimes. Sorry, Paul. Lawyers do occasionally get a bad rap, but at the same time, they do donate an awful lot of time, certainly for landmark cases such as this. So this case, what's it all about? Where is it going to go to? What are we looking for?
So we're seeking a declaration that these particular laws are unconstitutional. So the way that works, in Australia, we don't have a Bill of Rights. Which is a tragic situation for many lawyers, feel that that's an unfortunate situation. But what we do have is a constitution, and the constitution is what sets up our system of government. And in that constitution, the courts have implied a particular freedom, which is the freedom of political communication. And the reason why that particular freedom has, it operates as a limit on the power of the legislature to enact laws. So they can't go too far into that space before the Constitution pulls them back. And the reason for that is that the Constitution enacts a representative democracy. And a representative democracy really relies on people having the people we elect being accountable to us, and us having enough knowledge to make a meaningful choice about what
who we elect, exactly.
And it kind of comes down to that phrase, we have a right to know what's done in our name. And so that's kind of where we hope that we can take the freedom of political communication argument in a discursive way where people demand to know. And I guess the Northern Territory issue is another example where people are saying, we demand to know what's being done with money that's our taxes. We demand to know what we're ultimately accountable for as the people that vote in politicians.
Who do public service. Now, part of the story that I read the other morning was talking about how perhaps refugee, and I don't know who came out with this, but how refugees may have to walk through sewage to get to meal areas, perhaps that female and children are in shower blocks and they're being watched by border security guards within those detention centres. Now, that has nothing to do with turning back the boats. It has nothing to do with security for the country, to do with protecting our borders. This is to do with actually people's rights. Now, if I was a doctor in Australia and I observed, let's say, abuse towards children, I'd be possibly fined or certainly jailed if I didn't report it. Whereas if I was a doctor examining people in detention and I reported, let's say, child abuse, what would happen to me then?
A lot of these issues are going to be questions before the court, and we can't ever preempt, first of all, what types of facts will be agreed between Doctors for Refugees and the Commonwealth. There might be some things we disagree about, there might be some things we agree about, but one of the questions before the court will be around this threat of a criminal charge if you make a mistake about the scope of an exemption. So one of the most key exemptions is where a disclosure is made, for example, with the consent of the person involved, but there's going to probably be factual questions around access, like consent to communicate to who, for example, in an offshore detention. The other issue is where a disclosure is made to lessen or prevent a serious threat to health or life. But if I was reading that as a doctor, I might be asking questions like, if the event has already happened, am I preventing or lessening that threat by reporting it now? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of complication in different provisions in the Act, and a lot of the exemptions are quite complex. And a second issue is that where you have laws that are different in their operation to the way our laws are, you not only have the law, but you also have whether people are, for example, being watched, like how the law is being used in terms of surveillance. Or so the AMA in May passed a unanimous motion to investigate the surveillance of doctors by the Australian Federal Police. Mm-hmm. I think that speaks volumes of what a big issue this is for the medical profession. The other issue is that there's been some very formal reports, for example, by the Australian Human Rights Commission, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, that are making comment on conditions that are really, really quite damning. Then this law is enacted, and subsequent to this law being enacted, the UN actually cancelled a visit because they didn't believe they'd be able to participate in the fact-finding mission because there was no undertaking given that criminal charges wouldn't be laid on people who participated.
Yeah, look, it sounds like a very complex case. How long do you think this will go on for? It's a high court challenge. I don't know. It's not going to take 12 days like a county court case. Or how long do you think it'll go for?
That's entirely up to the courts, actually. But we would be pushing for an expedited kind of timeline. But I think another very strong part of this case is building up the advocacy around it. So already we've had an endorsement from the Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. We've also had an endorsement from the Social Workers Union. So pushing those types of statements of endorsement where people are expressing, yes, this law is causing us issues as well, and fear and trepidation. I mean, another classic example was the removal of the Save the Children staff from Manison. I think that those types of issues, there's a lot of people who feel intimidated, concerned, and I guess that's the kind of backdrop. But I'm not sure. Many of these things might become factual questions before the court of what's... So I'm only discussing what's been in public reports. Sure. It is a complex case, but for us, the key message is the advocacy, which is, you know, there's people who are in detention. They're seeking asylum in Australia. The places where they're being held are managed by corporations who've contracted with our government. And treatment and conditions in those centres, the question that's brought before the court is that something that ought to be part of the ordinary political discourse? Or are the reasons that have been put forward by the government, which involve the risk of criminal activity a professional environment, are they adequate to have this veil of secrecy around?
Yeah. Look, it's sort of like, as you mentioned before, the Northern Territory photos and conditions and situations that came out, and they do need to be reported because up until they are reported, it's just sort of left as in a veil of secrecy. Now, secrecy is a theme, and I'll ask you to hang around for a little bit too, Megan, because we have a census coming up next Tuesday, and I urge everybody listening to the Informer not to fill out their census form during the Informer, maybe to leave it until after the Informer or before the Informer next Tuesday night. But we're going to be talking about secrecy and the census.
With census night just around the corner on August the 9th, there has been some concerns raised around the issues of privacy, confidentiality and the security of information that is provided by people as part of the census. Tonight we're going to speak with Ben Decray, who is a privacy advocate, about these issues and how the Australian Bureau of Statistics collects, uses, discloses and stores your personal information that you give as part of doing the census. Can you hear us, Ben?
Can we hear you, Ben? seems that we're having a little bit of a problem with the line for Ben, so we're going to try him again. In the meantime, it is census night next week, and everybody has to fill out a census. I heard that there are fines for not filling out your census. Oh, Ben, I think you're just coming through there.
I think we can hear you.
I can't actually hear you, unfortunately, but apparently you can hear me.
We can hear you, Ben. One moment.
Tell you what I'm going to do. So I'm going to go next door and I'm going to grab the radio and I'm going to bring
No, no, it's cool. Don't worry. Don't worry, Ben. Everything's okay.
Can you hear us now, Ben?
I can hear you now.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
You probably didn't hear that intro that I gave, but you're a privacy advocate. Is that right?
I am indeed, yes.
And what does that mean, being a privacy advocate?
I just think that people have a right to privacy, and there's a lot of situations in which that's not afforded to us, and the census this year is one of those instances.
And why particularly the census this year? Why is that an issue in relation to privacy, do you think?
So one of the largest changes is that they're now planning on retaining the names and addresses against all of the answers that we give on the census.
Yeah.
The counter to that that we've heard is that they've been retaining this information for 100 years since the census started.
Right.
And while that may be true, it's the response that the ABS come back to us with. There's a very big difference between what they're doing with the data now. So whereas originally they would gather the name and address so that they would be able to make sure that the census was completed by every household,
yes,
because it's a census of households, not a census of people particularly, they would need to be able to contact people to say, look, we didn't get your form, or we couldn't read the answer to question number 5, or any of these qualitative types of checks.
Follow-up type, yeah.
Exactly. Once they had all the information and it was put into the system, the answers would be in their system without a link back to the person or the household that had given it, and the name and address would be destroyed. So when they said they maintained information for up to 18 months, it was predominantly for that purpose. What they're planning to do now is to retain it for up to 4 years and to link names and addresses with the responses in the census, rather than, whereas previously the answers were anonymous, they are now essentially personally identifiable.
So before, they would take our names and addresses and, you know, after a period of making sure that they've got the information, they just drop that all off. Is that right, or...?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Like before, when they had our names and addresses, because they were collecting census from each of our houses, after they knew that everybody's census were okay and they were correctly filled out and whatever and didn't need to follow up, would they just drop our names and addresses off?
That's correct. So the names and addresses weren't stored with the answers. They were erased from the. They were just dropped completely once those answers had been entered into their systems.
Has there been any indication given as to what that information will be kept for? Is there any purpose to keeping that information past the compilation of the census information?
Sure. So the primary reason that they're giving is that they want to be able to enhance data. So at the moment they get information from us through the census and through the ABS also run a number of other surveys.
Yeah.
And they want to be able to correlate that data together to get a bigger picture of Australia, as they call it.
Enhance, that's a little bit worrying. I'm looking at Megan at the moment and I don't know, I feel a bit worried, Megan. What about you? Enhance.
Yeah, I feel a bit nervous about filling out the census now. I wasn't aware. I wonder, has there been much resistance to this?
There's been a fair amount of resistance. So obviously within my circles, there's a lot of chatter. It's hard for me to gauge how that is across the nation. I would like to hope that everybody in Australia is outraged about this. But realistically, there's probably quite a lot of people who have no idea. The marketing campaigns from the ABS have been very thoroughly directed towards encouraging people to complete the census. And I should point out that I don't believe there's anybody in Australia who doesn't actually want to complete the census. It's a very valuable piece of information, and it's information that we need in order to improve services throughout Australia. The problem that exists is the fact that because the data is now identifiable to the person giving the answer, we have an issue of trust, and there's a very good chance that the data will actually now be of a worse quality.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Hawthorne effect. There was a study done at a...
Sorry, I can only think of the football team, but no.
So
the Hawthorne effect was a study carried out in the UK at a factory where they were trying to determine whether people were more or less productive in different lighting conditions. So they got their workers in a factory to work under better lighting conditions, brighter lighting conditions, and then they repeated the test under darker lighting conditions. And what they found was that people were more productive when the lights were brighter.
Okay.
Future studies then showed that that wasn't actually the case. And what was happening was that because people felt they were being observed under lighter conditions, they would work harder because they felt that people were watching them, whereas under the darker conditions, they felt that they didn't have to work as hard because people weren't questioning their every move. And the same is going to happen with the sensors. People are feeling like they're being watched because their answers are tied to them.
Yes.
So they're going to think, well, if I answer in this way, what are the implications of that answer?
So
what,
I'd better maybe...
Yeah,
I can see what you mean. True. I mean, you know, actually one of the changes I do know in the census for sure, and certainly we've been discussing here at Joy 94.9, is that there is a change to the gender question. It's no longer male or female. There are also provisions for people to write down whether they maybe identify differently, and certainly there's another area. So people may also be less likely to identify, let's say, as trans or intersex, and that won't be, you know, that'll be part of that Hawthorne effect that you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Would you really give away that type of information when you don't know what the next government are going to do with it?
So there's a potential there with that sort of big brother approach, if I can use that term, that people aren't going to be completely honest, is basically what you're saying, and the information that's gathered as part of the census is perhaps going to not reflect the Australian community as best it could.
Absolutely. Given historical observations on the effect of observing somebody when they're giving answers, I would say that there's no doubt that the information is going to be less accurate this year.
Okay. Interesting.
I was mentioning to David before that the only types of legal advices I'd been asked to give in relation to this issue was around people feeling persecuted through the census process. So, for example, people from a particular background might feel that it's part of a government interrogation or, you know, an ASIO-type investigation into Muslim people or that sort of thing. And you know, we always felt quite confident with our responses in the way that the information would not be used. So you've certainly given me something to go and take back to the office and research.
Sure. And you hit on a very good point there, is that the marginalised communities are definitely at risk from this. But a friend of mine told me the other day an interesting perspective. One of the things that the ABS have said they've done in the past few years, largely, I believe, without public disclosure, is to correlate some of the data from the Immigration Department databases with their information within the census, within the ABS. So when they say they don't share information, that's correct, but they do get information. My understanding is they get information from a couple of other departments in order to correlate that and get that broader picture. And a hypothesis was put to me, what if they get... So a comment was made earlier in this segment about medical data or pharmaceutical benefit scheme. What if they manage to correlate data about the drugs you buy from a chemist along with the land you own, benefits you get from Centrelink and the treatments you get at a hospital, cars that you buy, all sorts of information.
Basically
that's gathered
profile
from the
how much we're costing.
Well, the thing is, they're not just linking that to you, they're also linking it to linking the answers from everybody in your household to you as well. So there's a huge amount of information here that could potentially be used in ways that we just can't even imagine yet.
Look, it's been great talking to you tonight. Certainly food for thought, Ben. I'd like to thank both of our guests tonight, Megan Fitzgerald from the Fitzroy Legal Service and Ben Dacry for information on the census. Tonight's program was produced by myself, David Gale, with the assistance of Paul McClure.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.